Good evening. Welcome to Behind the News for July 6th, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And two guests up for tonight. First, in about 10 minutes or so, we'll speak with James Howard Kunstler, author of the book Geography of Nowhere and many other books, and proprietor of a blog whose name I cannot say on the radio, but the first part of it is Cluster, and you can probably complete the rest of it in your mind. And we will talk to him about why the United States is so ugly and peak oil and things like that. And then at the bottom of the hour, Katha Pollitt, the Nation columnist and author of the new collection of essays, Virginity or Death, just out from Random House, will be joining us in the studio. And before we get to all that, a couple of items in the news. First of all, poor Ken Lay, huh? I love the Post headline today, or the Post cover, before they put Ken Cheeto Lay's coffin in the ground, make sure he's in it. And I noticed the conspiracy theorists were busily at work. I got an email today from somebody who said Lay's heart attack was faked, and he was probably killed by the CIA or something. Man, God. There is just no end to this business of inventing conspiracies, is there? And that I'm sure people are already composing their emails denouncing me for that observation, but I await their arrival in my inbox when I get back to the office in about an hour and a half. Anyway, in the economic headlines this morning, the Labor Department reporting at the tally of jobless claims last week, the number of people who lost their job and went over to the unemployment office to sign up for benefits fell by 2,000 last week, which was somewhat better than people were expecting. Not by much, though. That follows 2 weeks of small increases. And the four-week moving average, which is what people really look at in order to smooth out the week-to-week volatility, rising slightly. But the trend over the last several weeks is pretty flattish. After a long decline from last September or so into the beginning of this year, a ragged rise for the first 4 or 5 months of the year, it's now settled down to a point where the job market looks good but not great. And I should point out that only about 40% of the unemployed these days are drawing unemployment insurance benefits, that is because of a series of revisions to the regulations over the years that made it narrower and narrower coverage for unemployment insurance, and also more and more people on irregular and contract work and therefore not covered under the unemployment insurance system. The movement in this jobless claims indicator is a pretty good measure of what's going on with the state of the job market. Tomorrow morning at 8:30, we will get the June employment report. I'm expecting gains of solid but not spectacular gains, which is what's the trend has been in recent months. The financial markets yesterday were stunned when ADP, the people who print a lot of about one out of every six paychecks in the United States, the ADP has been issuing their estimate of what's coming out in the Friday jobs numbers every month now. And the first couple of times they did that, they started last May, the first couple of times they did it, it was greeted with kind of a shrug. But yesterday, they were predicting a number much, much bigger than everyone was expecting. The financial markets went crazy, thinking that if the economy is producing that many jobs, the Fed will almost certainly continue to tighten provoke the economy into a slowdown or something worse. Now today, second thoughts about that. And one of the reasons for those second thoughts, the Institute for Supply Management, the Organization of Trade Association for Purchasing Managers, the people who buy things for corporations and who are presumably in good touch with the state of the business, they do a monthly survey, one for manufacturing companies and one for non-manufacturing, meaning mostly service companies. The service one came out this morning, showing an expanding service sector, but at a smaller than expected rate and at a declining rate. So two consecutive months of declines in the ISM Services Index, and the employment index going from 58 last month, the month of May, rather, to 52. And any number above 50 signifies an expansion. Any number below 50 signifies a contraction. But 52 is barely above 50, and so that suggests that service industries are only hiring modestly. And that is in accordance with what all the surveys are suggesting. The Hudson Company, which is a think tank consulting firm that does a monthly survey of employees, reporting that something like close to half of all workers they surveyed last month reporting that they're concerned about the state of their finances. This is not the kind of thing you'd expect to be seeing 5 years into economic expansion, this has been really characteristic of this whole expansion all along. It's been very, very, very good for corporate profits, very, very good for people at the top of the income distribution, but the rest of us have been just limping along. And I was just looking at some of these numbers myself yesterday. Since this expansion began in late 2001, corporate profits have expanded by an average rate of close to 30% a year. 30%, oh, it's 28% a year. That is a remarkable number, and there's just no precedent for that in anywhere in U.S. Economic history, at least since the end of World War II when the good numbers start. By contrast, average incomes up a cumulative total of 5%. That is, not 5% a year, but 5% over the last 5 years, while corporate profits are up 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 times that much. So corporations doing very, very well. Rich people doing very, very well. The rest of us, not. The ISM Manufacturing Index, which, getting back to that one, the Institute for Supply Management, the purchasing managers in the manufacturing sector also reporting a slower rate of expansion, again, the second consecutive decline, and their index of employment going below 50, suggesting contraction in the manufacturing sector. This index goes back to the 1950s, but for the last 5 years or so, it's the actual performance of the manufacturing sector in terms of employment has been much worse than that would have been what would have been suggested by this ISM index, but it too falling, and so these measures of employment not looking so good. So it will be quite a lot of suspense at 8:30 this tomorrow morning when the Bureau of Labor Statistics releases the June job numbers. Consumers showing more upbeat attitudes. The ABC Washington Post weekly survey of consumer attitudes up 1 point on the week. They're retracing almost all the losses that index showed in April and May. Very strange but sharp decline, now almost completely reversed, so we're just about back to where we were in the early spring. At a middling level. So again, 5 years into economic expansion, you'd expect attitudes to be far more optimistic than they actually are. And also a very, very wide gap between people at the top of the income distribution and people at the bottom. That's normal, but also a very, very wide partisan gap with Democrats seeing the economy as pretty bad, Republicans seeing it as pretty good, and that partisan gap is unusually wide. This ABC series goes back into the 1970s. We haven't seen anything this wide in the history of the series, but it's persisted over the last few years. Very strange division in perceptions of the economy. And that housing sector refusing to roll over and die. The Mortgage Bankers Association reporting this morning, I believe, that applications for new mortgages up last week, both for new purchases and for refinancings. So this has been in a downtrend for a considerable period of time, but now it's kind of flattening out. And you'd expect with rising interest rates and signs that the housing market is losing air that we might see a little decline in these mortgage applications, but not yet. So optimism persists among house buyers. And we'll be back in a moment to speak with James Howard Kunstler after this musical break.
I'm traveling in a car with several people. It's a white, late 50s, early 60s style car. And I'm in the back taking it all in leisurely. And we're in the California driving around West Hollywood and Beverly Hills. And I've got a flyer that spouts some revolutionary dogma. I'm telling the other passengers that it's time we became leftist radicals again. And I substantiate my theories by pointing out the fact that modern culture that passes outside our window. And see Carr from the Village Voices in the backseat with me. And she says, all your work is derogatory. And I'm hurt by this. And I explain to her that I'm not a negative person. I'm angered by so much of what's around us. And the mood lightens and we continue our joy ride. Everyone laughing as we go.
And that an excerpt from the song Joyride by Bongwater, a late 1980s band, and that was the voice of Karen Magnuson. Kramer, the principal musician behind her. And I thought that was a good setup for James Howard Kunstler, the Dreck of Modern Culture behind us. And James Howard Kunstler is one of our leading chroniclers of the Dreck of Modern Culture that litters our landscape. Welcome to WBAI and to Behind the News. Jim Kunstler, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, thank you for joining us. So,
did you say the Dreck of Modern Culture?
I did, indeed.
That's very good.
Well, I thought that song was quite appropriate to the subject matter here. You've written books on the ugliness of our built landscape in the United States. You feature an eyesore of the month on your website.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, I was reading an essay by H.L. Mencken, who on the occasion of taking a cross-country train trip was reflecting on why everything was so ugly, and he said it couldn't just be a lack of taste. It had to be a positive taste for ugliness that made the American landscape
so ugly.
Well,
that was his famous essay, The Libido for the Ugly. And he concluded that there was some kind of positive sort of tropism or you know, biological need for ugliness in the people who had settled America. But actually, I don't think that's really the case. And, you know, it took me about 20 years to arrive at what I thought was a coherent view of what this is all about.
All right. Well, let us know. What is it all about? Why? I mean, I think it's underestimated as a serious problem of our culture and of our politics, just how ugly stuff is. So help us figure out why.
That's only the most, you know, superficial outward manifestation of the dreck that we have made out of our everyday environment in the last 50 years or so. But, you know, there's many ways that you can state it. One way that I'm fond of stating it is that the immersive ugliness of the everyday environment in America, the highway strips and the signage and all that crap, is entropy made visible. And the physicists always kind of twang on me for saying that. But I think it truly is a matter of entropy in the sense that it's kind of the spiritual waste product of this vast energy-intensive industrial process that we've been, you know, using and availing ourselves of for the last 100 years. And this is one of the manifestations. Other manifestations are things like pollution, you know, bad water, bad air. You know, I would even take it so far and say that some cultural things like pornography, you know, sadomasochism is another example of entropy. And by entropy, I mean, you know, a force in reality, in nature, that tends to take things in the direction of death and deadness and deadliness. This is kind of consistent with some of the theories of the great architectural metaphysician Christopher Alexander, the author of the famous book, A Pattern Language, from the 1960s, and his later books actually truly are books of metaphysics. His new one is called The Nature of Order, and it's a wonderful, wonderful book. So that probably was a longer answer than you wanted.
No, we've got time. This is non-commercial radio.
Let me add one.
Well, was it always thus? Oh, okay, go ahead, your thing.
Huh? Was it always thus?
Yeah.
No, clearly it is. It wasn't. I mean, if you know, there is no medieval Cleveland.
Well, I'm talking about.
You know, there's no Renaissance St. Louis.
But before World War II, it seemed like Americans were capable of building attractive buildings and attractive towns and cities, and now we seem incapable of that. Where'd that capacity go?
Well, Well, I do think that it's, it does represent tremendous entropy, and also the diminishing returns of technology. You know, in fact, what you're seeing is a lot of mass-produced crap. And what we did was, you know, we developed methodologies and abilities to produce tremendous amounts of this stuff, but the downside of it, or the diminishing return of it, was that the quality of it was terrible, and it was done without thought and without care. And when you do things without thought and care, you end up with a lot of problems.
When I was back in, back in the mid '70s, I took an architecture course with Vincent Scully, who had us read Robert Venturi's Learning from Las Vegas, and we were taught there that our buildings must learn to live with the cigarette machine, although that seems kind of quaint now. But also that Las Vegas is almost all right, Main Street is almost all right. There was beauty in things that high culture types thought were ugly. What do you make of that?
Well, I interviewed Venturi and his wife Denise Scott Brown when I was writing my original book on this subject in 1990, The Geography of Nowhere. And, I think what Venturi represented was really just kind of a surrender to the crap. And that has actually been taken quite a bit further by Rem Koolhaas, which is, Rem Koolhaas not only surrenders to the disorder deadliness of our surroundings, but he takes it a step further and just celebrates it. So that's the direction that the more high-toned sector of architecture has been taking things. But, the public really doesn't like that stuff, obviously. You know, they regard it at best with a kind of stupefied awe, and at worst, they realize this stuff makes them feel miserable. You know, like the new Seattle Public Library downtown, just a ghastly building full of all kinds of cognitive traps on the inside that attempt to deceive you and disorient you.
Now, there are
deliberately.
There are people who would argue that that people like the strip, that this is democratic culture. This is what people
That's
want.
That's what Venturi argued.
Yeah. Well, what's your response to that kind of argument?
Well, there's a whole general set of arguments that you find from characters like David Brooks of the New York Times and Peter Huber over at Forbes magazine. And their argument is generally that that suburbia must be okay and all of its trappings must be okay because Americans like it. But that's really a tautology, and represents a fatuous form of thinking. The reason we got that stuff was simply because we were able to do it due to the special circumstances of the late 20th century and early 21st century. The time is fast approaching when we won't be able to do that stuff, and we won't have it anymore, and we won't be able to use the stuff that's there. So, whether people like it or not is going to end up not mattering that much. It's more a matter of what reality permits you to do.
So let's move on. I should say I'm speaking with James Howard Kunstler, author and blogger and speaker on matters of architecture and urban design. You are a partisan of peak oil theory.
My latest book includes my latest book, The Long Emergency, is largely about the global oil predicament and where we're going with that and how it's going to affect us.
Now, my own personal opinion is that the greater danger is that we burn the oil we have rather than worrying about running out of it several decades hence.
That's a reasonable fear.
Which one?
Although the prospect is that we're just going to continue burning it.
Well,
the realistic prospect is that we're going to keep on burning that and the coal that we have.
Yeah, well, that coal thing is scary. But, we had yesterday, I think, oil closed at a nominal high. If we were to match the real highs of the early 1980s, we'd have to get closer to $100 a barrel. But still, we're now experiencing the most expensive oil we've had in 25 years. Is this going to make people wake up, or are we just going to do increasingly desperate and stupid things and doom civilization and human life?
I happen to believe that our delusional thinking about this stuff and the issues that it implies will tend to get worse. That expect more delusional thinking, not less, because as the global oil predicament gains traction and begins to express itself in economics, is going to cause tremendous discontinuity and distress in many of the mechanisms that we're comfortable with and take for granted. You know, everything from industrial agriculture to big box shopping and 12,000-mile manufacturing supply lines between Philadelphia and China and so on. And as that stuff gets into trouble, I think we're going to have a very hard time processing the information. You can already see it. I mean, hello?
Hello, go ahead.
Yeah. You know, the mainstream media's inability to process this stuff is just stupendous. Just last Sunday, the New York Times Sunday Magazine ran a cover story about automobile use in China and how it's growing and, you know, what the scene is like over there. And the word oil only appeared once in the whole article, in the second to last paragraph, and only for one sentence. And the one sentence that was there was completely stupid. What it said was, in effect, by the year 2030, China and America would be competing for oil imports. Well, there may not be any oil imports at all to even compete for in that period. So,
yeah, according to
not only did they give short shrift to the subject, but what the little shrift they gave it, they completely misunderstood what was going on.
Well, according to BP, we've got about 40 years of oil left, regardless.
Yeah, complete nonsense.
Well, let's just even assume that let's just bracket that for a moment, but just assume that's true. You know, with 25 years from now, 2030, we're going to be a long way along that route. Even if that's true, we should actually be thinking about a post-oil era, but it seems like the New York Times Magazine is incapable of that.
Well, look, there's no institution that I know of in America that's capable of thinking clearly about this stuff. Let me give you an example. If we had any brains at all, we would be repairing the American passenger railroad system. There's no other project that we could undertake right away that would have a bigger impact on our oil use. Plus, it would be a huge benefit to all classes of people. Plus, it would put tens of thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, to work in meaningful jobs at all kinds of different levels with decent pay. It would be a project that could give us confidence to go on to do other things that we have to do. The fact that we're not even talking about it shows how unserious we are.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that that's just too sensible for the American political system to think about. It really seems like a structural incapacity to think of this.
Well,
sort of
it does
thing.
Make you wonder. You know, I'm not I'm actually not a political radical. I'm sort of a mainstream centrist registered Democrat. Although I must say, I think that the Democratic Party is profoundly lost and profoundly disappointing. But I'm not a radical, but it's becoming clear that politically we can't handle any of these issues. But the media itself is failing, and we're not able to have a coherent public discussion about these things. And in the absence of a meaningful public discussion, how are we going to arrive at any consensus about what to do?
Well, you say you're not a radical, but let's think for a moment about the kinds of things we're talking about. We're talking about the fact that the spatial arrangement of American life, the suburbs, the sprawl, the interstates, all that stuff, are unsustainable. Whether it's because we're running out of oil or because we're running out of air, one or the other, it's going to be unsustainable. We're talking about the devalorization of massive amounts of capital in the oil industry, the auto industry, and related sectors. That kind of thing implies a pretty radical break with the existing order, and we don't even have a glimmer of a consciousness about it, much less a plan for accomplishing it.
Yes. Although these are things the things that you've described are things that are probably going to happen. They're not necessarily things I'm advocating. I'm merely describing, the kind of conditions that we're heading into. I'm not saying that we should live in hardship or that our standard of living should go down. You know, what I'm saying is prepare for it. It's happening.
Well, what kinds of if we were rational and we had a more rational political system, aside from reconstructing the railroad system, what kinds of things are you talking about?
Well, we face a whole array of tasks in a kind of an American perestroika, you know, if you would allow me to use that term. And let me point out that one of the clues that your listeners ought to be alert to is the fact that the only thing we're talking about right now is how to run our cars by some other means. That's all we care about is how we're going to run the cars. You know, whether we run them on biodiesel or liquefied coal or, you know, or use French fried potato oil. We have got to take the conversation beyond that, and we're going to have to start talking about how we do agriculture in this nation, because industrialized agriculture is not going to make it. You know, the Archer Daniel Midland model of pouring gas and oil, fertilizers and herbicides on the soil in order to produce vast quantities of cheese doodles, that system ain't going to make it. We're going to have to pay attention to rebuilding local networks of economic interdependence, because life is going to become a lot more local in an energy-scarce future. We're not going to be having those 12,000-mile manufacturing supply lines to China for our household products forever. We're going to have to make other arrangements for that. And we're going to have to rebuild local networks of commerce and business that were, by the way, systematically destroyed by the national chains. We're going to have to reorganize the way we do schooling. My guess is that the enormous state universities and these gigantic institutions are probably not going to make it. In fact, you can state categorically that anything, any enterprise organized on a large, giant scale is probably going to be in trouble, whether it's the federal government or RJR Nabisco or the University of Michigan. We're going to have to downscale the things we do. We're going to have to inhabit the landscape of North America differently. And I'm not saying that to be mean. The fact is that suburbia is going to fail us in more than one way. You know, it's going to fail logistically. It's going to fail in terms of money and value. We're going to have to make other arrangements for that. We're probably going to have to return to traditional modes of settlement, you know, towns, cities on a different scale than the giant cities of the 20th century. Those great metroplexes are probably going to contract substantially. And, you know, my guess is that some of them some of them will densify at their centers and along their waterfronts. But an awful lot of the fabric of those places is going to end up being valueless and probably depopulated.
Well, so, as you say,
know,
this,
we're facing just tremendous, overwhelming tasks.
There, as you say, there's an ad in the TV in the studio here saying that Dallas is the number one city in America and is rapidly growing. So,
that's the current situation. You know, to extrapolate that and suppose that Dallas or Orlando or Houston will continue to grow in the way that they have been, you know, people are going to be disappointed about that. Places like Houston and Phoenix and Las Vegas are going to be in particular trouble.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, James Howard Kostner.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm glad to be with you, Doug.
Okay, and I hope to have you back sometime because this is important stuff.
Okay, well, you know how to get a hold of me.
I do indeed. All right, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with James Howard Kostner, author of many books, The Geography of Nowhere and The Long Emergency. And you can find his website by searching for his name, James Howard Kostner. Speak the name of his blog over the radio because the FCC wouldn't like that, but it's a great one. Let's take a little break for station ID, and we'll be back to speak with Katha Pollitt.
Greetings. This is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York. Enjoy.
And we're back. This is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And you can also find us on the web at WBAI.org. And And you can also find my shows archived on my website, leftbusinessobserver.com, all one word, leftbusinessobserver.com. And you can find shows going back to 2002 archived there in hi-fi or lo-fi, depending upon your bandwidth. And let's take a little musical break and listen to Tracy and the Plastics while we get Katha Pollitt seated in the studio. That little bit of Tracy and the Plastics, which is actually just one person. I think her name is Wynn Greenwood, an arts graduate of Bard College, who synthesizes her alternative personas that she sings with, who are the Plastics, and she's Tracy. And that was a song called Henrietta. And now we're joined in the studio by Katha Pollitt, who is the author of, a Nation columnist and author of the collection, Virginity or Death, collection of her Nation columns. And other material as well, besides Nation columns, Katha, is it just Nation columns?
It has an introductory essay that's all new.
Okay, so Virginity or Death, that's a pretty catchy title. What's that mean?
That's the choice that the religious right is giving women. If you're going to have sex, you should risk death. It takes off from a column of the same name about the human papilloma virus vaccine that was recently developed and is just about to come on the market, which the Focus on the Family and Family Research Council said, you know, this is going to encourage young girls to be promiscuous. We can't let them have it.
So the answer is just wait till marriage, right?
Well, right, because if you knew that you wouldn't get cervical cancer from HPV in midlife and you were 15, of course you wouldn't have sex.
And that's, of course, the way a horny adolescent thinks, right?
Exactly, exactly. You always think ahead when you're a kid.
Yes. I don't mean to bring up an unpleasant subject, but you were your book out of rather unpleasant review in the New York Times book review. And it was many of these things, it pretended to be fresh and bold and new thinking, but it was actually kind of very conventional and stupid. But what is it about feminism that brings out these kinds of reviews, do you think?
I was asking myself the same question. You know, that review, which is by Anna Marie Cox, a.k.a. Wong Cat, begins with the word strident feminism, and it goes on from there, and how she wants to wear stilettos, and I'm all excited about a story I saw about women who cut off their toes to fit into their stilettos, and she's thinking, hey, maybe it would work. I should try this. And then she goes on, you know, stridency. I'm thinking, is there another major social movement where the major beneficiaries of that social movement are upset at the notion that anyone might think that movement, quote, strident, unquote? I mean, do young black people say, you know, oh, Martin Luther King, he was so strident, you know? Do workers
say, well,
oh,
are
Samuel Gompers, what a strident guy.
Are men ever strident?
Strident is a completely, like shrill, it's a completely genderized marker, adjective. Men are never strident or shrill. Men are forceful and bold.
Or polemical.
or polemical, which or is, angry, or
these are all considered
or right.
Virtues.
How about that? Men are right.
Of course, Ann Coulter is never called strident, is she?
No, she never is. She's called some other things, but not that.
Well, what is it about feminism? Do you have a theory of what it is about this movement, which in many ways is one of the most successful social movements ever, yet it's constantly disowned, constantly pronounced dead, constantly denounced? What
yes,
is it?
And not only that, it's constantly denounced by its beneficiaries. And I think that one reason is that as every victory that feminism, the women's movement, obtains, becomes encoded into society and it loses its feminist marker. For example, the fact that half of all medical students are women. The fact that any day you open the – look at your New York Times, there are women with front page bylines. This is all the result of
which 30 years ago would have been pretty
never,
rare.
No, it would never have happened. You now have women in every field and women doing all kinds of things. Of course, the gains are extremely uneven, but still they're there. And yet they're detached from the social movement that gave them their possibility. And in fact, you will find people who will argue, people on the right, who will argue that, oh, this all would have happened anyway. This is just the progress of history.
Spontaneously.
Yeah, it's just spontaneous. People just, you know, getting better. Life gets better all the time.
I'm speaking with Katha Pollitt, author of the collection Virginity or Death, just out from Random House. Well, that you mentioned all the women in school, all the women in medical school, all the women in colleges, and now we're treated to a lot of public hand-wringing over the fact that boys are not doing so well and that they're being left behind in this increasingly feminized educational system. What do you make of that stuff?
Well, you know, I have some pieces about that in the book.
That's why I asked you the question.
Yeah. Oh, good. I think there are two in there. But if you look carefully at the statistics, and there was just a report that came out that proved that my instinct was correct, boys, quote unquote, are not doing badly. The real problem is with low-income boys and especially low-income black and Latino boys. And I think there are a lot of reasons for all of that. But if you look at
But there's something interesting about why that class problem is gendered the way it is.
Well, yes, it is. And I think one reason for that and for the larger phenomenon of more girls going to college than boys is that there are still good working class jobs for boys, hard as it may be to believe, or at least boys think they're out there. But girls know there are no good working class jobs for girls. You need even to get a good working class job for a girl, you need some college. If you want to be a medical technician, even if you want to be a secretary now, a job you used to be able to get right out of high school, they want you to have college. So if you would take a sister or a brother in the same working class family, the brother can think, I'm going to go be an electrician, I'm going to repair computers, I'm going to be, I don't know, a house painter. The girls, we still have a very gender segregated economy. And so that girl is thinking, I'm going to be a waitress if I don't go to college.
Yeah, it's remarkable that even though the professions have been very integrated sexually, the traditional working class jobs have not. So you have more than 95% of truck drivers are male. More than 95% of secretaries are female. You have a whole list of these. It's a strange thing, and it barely gets talked about. But it's why do you suppose there is this persistence of segregation in working class jobs?
That's a very good question. I think that there are some job occupations where that's not so true. For example, bus drivers. Some good unionized blue-collar jobs like, automobile manufacturing is now – there are a lot of women doing that. Of course, there isn't that much automobile manufacturing going on anymore. I think that, you know, a lot of those old male crafty kinds of jobs are – they have a very masculine work culture. They're probably not too friendly if a woman shows up and wants to do construction or wants to, you know, be a plumber. She doesn't have, a lot of happy experiences. And so it's easier for her to be a cosmetologist.
Which is going to make a lot less money than being a plumber.
A lot less money, yeah. also vocational education here in New York City, which we think of as a big progressive place. Vocational education is completely gender segregated. And every now and then there's some little gesture made toward, oh, yeah, we should get more girls, you know, learning, I don't know, aviation. But it remains pretty much gender segregated.
Yeah, the building trades are egregious.
They are. And for a long time, unions were, you know, just as they were often quite racist, they were often quite sexist, too.
You have many pieces in the book about abortion and a lot of politics around gender relations does seem to circulate around that issue. Why is it so central, do you think?
Well, I think it's central for a number of reasons. One is it's on the table. It is the central gender-related issue for the right. there's a big anti-choice movement, and so naturally and they're having victories all the time. So naturally one organizes and mobilizes around that. I think, though, that there's another reason, which is that a lot of the gains that women have made, and I think this is something that, young women might not like to think about, really are dependent on reproductive freedom. If you're going to postpone marriage, as women now do, the age of marriage is the latest it's ever been in American history. It's like 26. If you're going to have not just college but a period of professional training, you want to establish yourself in a career, you have to make your family or have enough money so that you don't need a family, you cannot have a baby when you're 17 years old. You can't have a baby when you're a sophomore in college, no matter what the feminists for life say. And if you do, you're really going to have a much harder time of it. I think it's very crucial. It's not some little out there bizarre right that, like, the right to, wear pants, or have six dogs in your one-room apartment. It's really fundamental.
Yeah, I was trying to find a quote from George Gilder's really crazy 1970s book, Men and Marriage, which I was paging through it before I came down here, and I couldn't find the quote. But he's got something in there. It's an insane book and really worth tracking down. But one of the reasons it's so interesting is it reveals a lot of the complete madness behind a lot of respectable right-wing thought. But one of the points he makes is that abortion and contraception give women control over sexual relations. And it removes a form of masculine domination, and he's against it. And he also is against the feminization of the classroom. He thinks it's a terrible thing.
Yeah.
And it's really remarkable to read George Gilder as, like, the guy who really tells the truth about all this stuff.
Yeah, well, what's funny is George Gilder also has the idea, like a lot of right-wingers do, that men are the sort of nature's barbarians, and women's job is to civilize men. And they do this by marrying them, that single men are just the most dangerous, weird characters in the world. So women need to marry them and get them to settle down. And if you don't have that going on in society, then you're in big trouble. So then women are supposed to make all kinds of trade-offs of whatever, you know, power or autonomy or whatever fun they could be having in order to do this very important social job of keeping men out of trouble.
But I think Gilder's daughter is a successful scientist, so he doesn't actually live what he writes for other people.
Well, a lot of those right-wingers don't. I mean, look at Ann Coulter. Is she married? Does she have 10 children? If you looked at their lives, they would actually be living the kinds of lives that they accuse us of leading.
And a lot of the women have nannies and
Like Catelyn Flanagan has a whole phalanx of people. She not only has a nanny, she has a personal assistant, she has a maid, I think she has a gardener. I mean, it's quite a
she's a really awful writer who deserves much more notoriety for how awful she is.
Yes.
So who is she? And what's
I'm sorry. Catelyn Flanagan writes for the now she's writing for Time, but she was at she had a lot of very high-end magazine real estate at one time. She had the New Yorker, she had the Atlantic Monthly. And her thing was hating working women, working mothers, and how your child won't really love you if you don't stay home, and your husband might not really love you or feel obliged to help you in your hour of need if you haven't really, you know, done the home
thing. Of
course,
she's married to some hedge fund dude or something who makes buckets of money, right?
Well, actually, he works for Mattel and is the person in charge of things like ice shows starring Barbie. she's not a any woman who writes a book saying I'm a stay-at-home woman mother is lying to you. She is a writer who works at home. I mean, I could describe myself as a stay-at-home mother. I'm a writer who works at home. So is John Updike. No one would ever call John Updike a stay-at-home father.
Well, that description is rarely applied to men, is it?
No, it never is because you respect that a man who has written a book has a professional identity, but a woman is able to deny that professional identity if she wants to be a great big hypocrite and sell a lot of copies of her book, which Caitlin Flanagan did not do, I'm happy to report.
Did not sell a lot of copies of her book.
I don't think so. I checked her out on BookScan at one point.
Well, that's
interesting. Of course, that's dangerous. I checked myself out on BookScan. I could use a little help from your readers.
Listeners should run out and buy a copy of Virginity and Death by a new collection from Katha Pollitt, whose voice that is, just out from Random House. Well, actually, that's an interesting point. Katie Royfe, who made a big splash some years ago.
Yeah, she
ago,
didn't sell a lot of copies either.
Also, one of these anti-feminists.
None of these anti-feminist books
sold fewer than 10,000. I sold more copies of Wall Street than Katie Royfe did of her, was it The Morning After? Was it's, that the book?
Yes. Well, congratulations. And it's a much better
book.
Well,
that's not a great achievement to sell more because she's sold fewer than 10,000 copies. And yet, the stuff gets hyped and hyped and hyped, but nobody buys it.
Yes, it's true.
Why is that?
Well, nobody buys it because the people who buy books about women are feminists, are women. Women don't want to read, oh, yeah, you thought you were raped, but really it was just bad sex. Or, oh, well, if you wait too long, you'll be infertile. or you should quit your job and stay home with children. These are not the kinds of things that women want to read because they know it's all nonsense. Why publishers keep thinking that these books are going to sell, I don't know. I think that is a fascinating question. But they do expect this. In fact, Sylvia Ann Hewlett wrote a book called In England it was called Baby Hunger, but they had to change the title here. It's called Creating a Life. And the point of that was you have to get married right away. You have to have children. Don't wait. You'll be sorry if you don't have more than one child, et cetera, et cetera. And this book sold so few copies against very high expectations that the New York Times actually ran a cover story on the front page about why isn't this book selling more copies? I think they should do that about my book.
Yes, they should. They owe you reparations after that bad review.
I think they do. I think they do, yes.
Although,
I think they know that, though. But
a bad review is better than none at all.
So people keep telling me.
Yes. Well, I think some librarians will order anything that's reviewed in the New York Times Book Review. So great is that tedious publication's power. The Democrats now are themselves and constantly being advised by pundits, urged to do this, embrace values, to co-opt some of the right's values rhetoric, and we should all get sensitive about religion now and all that. What do you make of that?
Well, I have divided feelings, but basically because in a democratic country, you have to kind of reach out. A politician can't necessarily be too rigid. However, I think that what many people are waiting for to hear from the Democrats is a note of vigor and sincerity and strength and truthfulness. So that when Howard Dean, who, I liked Howard Dean when he was running for president, but when he says, yes, I love the Bible and my favorite book of the New Testament is Job, which is in the Old Testament, you're just saying, oh my God, don't try it if you have to fake it.
He was somebody who was almost the word strident could almost be applied to, right? He was,
well, and it was.
That
remember
scream.
There's the thing, and this just shows you, too, how the media can make anyone look ridiculous. The scream was nothing. The scream was a big nothing. It was a completely, an accident of the noise level and the angle of the shoot and all like that. And eventually the media said, yeah, what was all that fuss about? But that was too, by then it was too late. It had been on TV like 700 times over a single weekend. And a lot of people who had liked Dean then immediately thought, uh-oh, well, maybe he is kind of weird. And that was that.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, in policy terms, he was actually fairly moderate.
Well, he was.
But he was perceived as a raving leftist lunatic.
Yes, I know. I don't understand that. I mean, well, I guess it was because he was one of the earlier politicians to say, well, maybe the war in Iraq isn't such a great idea.
Speaking of war, you have a piece in here kind of early in the collection called War and Peace. And first of all, you're talking about the anti-war rally in advance of the Afghanistan war.
Mm-hmm.
And you complain about the appearance of the Bread and Puppet Theater.
Oh, don't remind me.
you regret that? I was wondering.
They're good people. We should all be on the same side. Why can't we all just get along? But I did feel at that moment, going to that demonstration, I just felt, you know, we need an update. We need an update. We need some new language, some new imagery. We need to. I was thinking then about how we need to acknowledge, and this was before all those wars, all our current embroilments, that this isn't like Vietnam in certain important ways that are important to think about. For example,
Afghanistan, you're talking about.
Well, no, actually, I think I wrote that piece. It was before the war in Iraq. There was another piece that was before the war in Afghanistan. Or maybe I'm wrong. These wars tend to blur together after a while.
Yeah, this was November 2001. We're talking about.
Okay. But, you know, the whole that, I mean, we, well, they were just very different situations. No one having anything to do with Indochina ever came to this country and hurt anyone. You could really say about Vietnam, this doesn't make any sense at all. Now, in retrospect, our wars in the Muslim world seem a little more like Vietnam in that we're, you know, the quagmire element.
Well, Iraq does seem a lot like Vietnam.
Iraq seems more and more like Vietnam, including the mendacious basis of our involvement. And how hard it's going to be to get us out and how we've made everything worse and all the rest of it and all those war crimes, et cetera. But I just was feeling at that moment that basically the people who are against this war are the people who were against, you know, that long ago war. And I felt a sense that we were a small group. Now we're a much bigger group. But look, you know, even though more than half the people in the country say, oh, God, this is a real mistake, you know, how many politicians are speaking out against it? Not that many. Not that many.
Well, the Republicans are extremely skilled at coming up with phrases like cut and run.
Yeah.
That define the discourse and strike the fear of appearing weak to anyone who would remotely dare to criticize their policies, as a Bush advisor says, if you're denying your opponent's accusations while using their language, you're losing. And that's what the Democrats will say. We're not cutting and running. We're not cutting and running. But if you use that phrase, you know.
Well, yes. And this is, you know, there's a very good example of that. This is this constant attempt to sort of by the people who were for the war and have some dim sense it's not working out so well, that now the leftists, the anti-war people are supposed to solve that problem. For example, my erstwhile colleague Christopher Hitchens had a piece in Slate recently where he said, you know, here are four things that you peaceniks, you anti-war types, you know, should be doing since you're so against the war. And one of them was you should go to Iraq. And he lost me right there. I'm not going to Iraq. You should go to Iraq and be human shields around mosques and other kinds of buildings that, you know, are being blown up. And I'm thinking, why don't you go do that, Christopher? They were blowing up those buildings before we invaded their country. Why is it up to me to, you know, or, you know, and other people who are against the war to solve the problem that, you know, the people who were for the war created?
Well, his people screwed up big time.
Well, yeah, so it would be nice if he admitted that and said to Paul Wolfowitz, why don't you go be a human shield? I'll go too. We'll go together.
Well, you're an extremely skilled wordsmith and a poet. Why is it that they're so good at coming up with these phrases and we're not?
Well, I don't know. And, you know, that's very good because they've taken liberty, they've taken freedom, they've taken family, and they've managed – not only have they taken those sort of good big words, but they have managed to make us ashamed of our own self-descriptions. For example, liberal – and feminist. I just learned today, I had missed this news item, that the National Organization for Women at one point was even discussing whether they should drop use of the word feminist and call themselves, you know, humanists or something. I'm thinking, well, then you should call yourself the National Organization for Humans. But if you're the National Organization for Women, it's ridiculous to say, maybe we shouldn't call ourselves feminists. But it's the same thing when Michael Dukakis, you know, had trouble calling himself a liberal. Then the other side has really won when they control the discourse to such an extent.
Well.
So we have to take back language, and we have to take back the thoughts behind the language, too.
We also need to take over the institutions that give the word some force as well. But
right.
That's
so that's a lot.
Yeah, that's
and we'll do this by next week.
Yes,
okay.
let's get right on that. Yeah. And I hope the audience is getting on it too. And I hope the audience is also resolving to go buy a copy of Virginity or Death, the collection of essays from Katha Pollitt, who we've been speaking with, the book published by Random House. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. And I'm not sure when I'll be back because fundraising begins next week. Whenever I'll be back sometime. So have a good interval, and I'll see you next time. And let's go out with this piece of music from I think I'm going to get disowned by all my old punk rock friends for paying a little Bell and Sebastian, White Collar Boy.
Caught your little paw.
Your wage won't stretch to picking up checks.
A custodial sentence you narrowly avoided. Community service, you had to go along with your bang on the rocks at the old city docks.
Poor boy, poor boy, poor boy, poor boy. Poor boy, poor boy, poor boy, poor boy.
You were chained to a girl that would kill you with a look.
It's a nice way to die, she's so easy on the eyes.
Let's get away, but you played it by the book.
You're a warden.